Thomson Reuters Legal Ed Center and Celeste would like to welcome you to Limitations of Liability in Artificial Intelligence Contracts. It's now my pleasure to introduce our program speaker, Robert Scott of Scott & Scott LLP. Robert, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you for joining. Artificial intelligence is a rapidly developing area, and the law is trying to quickly catch up, and we'll talk today about a number of issues involving artificial intelligence in the law, focusing primarily on risk mitigation strategies and specific contract provisions for AI contracts that will enable you to help your clients navigate some of the legal challenges associated with artificial intelligence. A bit of background first. Industry analyst Gartner reports that the number of enterprises planning to implement AI grew 270% from 2015 to 2019. And according to their studies, large percentages of enterprises are actually deploying AI solutions. And while others have significant plans to adopt in the future, and yet in 2018, there were just 4% of the enterprise survey respondents that had AI solutions in production, and that rose to 14% in 2019, and I predict that those numbers will continue to increase as we see widespread adoption of certain artificial intelligence empowered solutions that are very much commercial ready and have a number of different applications. The Harvard Business Review predicts that AI will add $13 trillion to the global economy from 2019 to 2029. And so it's interesting to see that AI is in its early stages, but the predictions are that it's going to have widespread adoption and therefore significant implications legally, and we'll jump into some of those. One of the things that I have learned is that AI presents unique challenges for lawyers. I'm a technology attorney, have been practicing in software and IT services law for about 15 years now, and what I'm learning is that AI is a little bit different than what we've been dealing with, for example, in cloud or software as a service or other potentially related technologies. But there are new wrinkles, and certainly everything that we have been dealing with in terms of cloud solutions are in play, but there are some unique things that are definitely require legal attention and focus. And the first of those is confidential information. You know, what is confidential information? How is information related to input data, output data, and other items that, for example, a customer may load into an AI solution? You know, how is that, what is the ownership of that information? How is that to be treated under the contract? Is it trade secret protected? Is it contractually defined as confidential information? And are there use rights being granted, for example, related to a particular customer's use of an AI system, whether that be data that's being input or trainings that are being conducted within the model? And questions arise with respect to who owns the data and how can that data be used? Is that data shareable? Are the learnings shareable across multiple organizations? And it raises some significant not only privacy and security implications, but also trade secret implications. If you have an AI solution that you've been training and it's helping you from a business perspective, most would think that that could be a competitive advantage over others that haven't adopted such a solution. And yet it could be the case that your vendor, whom you have the relationship, could be theoretically using that same data, that same input, that same training to offer solutions to your competitors, and therefore the trade secret implications that are beyond the typical privacy and security implications that we think about when we're dealing with customer information. The other interesting piece is ownership. You know, who owns what components of an AI solution is a fairly complicated issue, because unlike typical software deployments where it's pretty clear that, you know, the code is compiled and maybe other pieces are separately compiled and it's relatively easy to kind of follow along with the IP, the IP remains static from the time of contracting through the term of the agreement, whereas in AI, the IP is not static. The IP ownership that the parties come to the relationship with at time of contracting could be substantially different than the IP that's in existence through the use of the tool. In addition, there can be many components in an AI solution working together, and many of the AI platforms are predicated or based in part on open source models, which hence the copyright, copy left reference here, that you both have copyright law questions with respect to proprietary applications, as well as copy left implications with respect to any AI solutions that are built on open source platforms that carry with them, for example, licensing rules in terms of notice, disclosure, potentially even contribution of code to the project. And so these are very important issues that need to be clearly identified with respect to what are the components, who owns the components. Those things are very important. In addition, regulatory compliance. We've got all of the privacy and security regulations that would govern, for example, hosted solutions or cloud-based solutions dealing with regulated customer or personally identifiable information. But it also is complicated when it comes to AI, because there are now very specifically targeted regulations that deal specifically with AI and under what circumstances AI can be used, and including prohibitions of profiling, for example, using AI, which the GDPR in Article 22 very expressly says that use of AI for profiling purposes in EU or on EU data subjects is prohibited. So we've got the regulatory compliance overlay that we have to be very concerned about. Sometimes it could be difficult to understand the respective roles of the various players within a AI ecosystem and whether or not those players are controllers or processors, as those terms are defined under GDPR. And we also have new regulations popping up. CCPA deals with California's privacy law. There's a New York Shield law that has recently been enacted. And as I said, a number of state regulations involving artificial intelligence usage specifically. Another area that is sort of unique to AI in some ways is data sharing and use rights. This is, again, related to number one in some ways, but to the extent that the parties are able to identify the confidential information that belongs to the parties respectively, in many instances there are data sharing and use rights agreements. Could be among the client with the client and a vendor, or it could be among groups of clients that, for example, in the healthcare context, are desirous of pooling data from multiple sources to make the AI solution more powerful. This is coming up in healthcare. It's coming up in a number of contexts where part of the power of the AI solution is the data set upon which it can operate, learn, and function. So data sharing and use rights are very important. And sometimes the secret sauce related to an AI solution is in fact the data. And that is unique in many respects relative to, for example, cloud or hosting that doesn't involve AI. So what are the legal implications of adoption of AI? I think you can imagine that there are quite a bit of potential scenarios. I think the most sort of prototypical use case that's been discussed among ethicists and technologists involving AI is the car that's driving along the trolley in San Francisco. It's an automated car. It's an autonomous vehicle. There is a adult and a child in the vehicle, and the vehicle detects that the trolley is about to turn over, and if it doesn't make an evasive maneuver, the vehicle will be crushed, and the passengers inside the vehicle will face significant harm and potentially death. And the autonomous vehicle has to make a decision. Does it stay where it is and allow the two people in the vehicle to get crushed, or does it make a hard left into a busy intersection that where there are multiple pedestrians, including women and children? And hence the dilemma is framed for an important decision that has potential legal liability. On the one hand, if the trolley crushes the car, the family of the driver and the child in the vehicle may bring a negligence or wrongful death claim or a products liability case potentially against the manufacturer of the vehicle, possibly even the company that is involved in the autonomous control. And if the vehicle decides not to protect the passengers, instead make an evasive maneuver that saves the passengers but winds up killing or injuring the pedestrians that are in the crosswalk, then those pedestrians and or their families could theoretically bring claims for negligence and or wrongful death or and or products liability related to the incident. So this is a sort of classic example of the types of issues that could become relevant and will become relevant as we start to see the rise of autonomous vehicles and other autonomous control devices that, for whatever reason, wind up causing injury or death. And, you know, it will be up to the courts to shake all that out. The other, you know, broad area of legal implications has to do with output and bias in output. You know, at its most powerful, AI solutions are capable of taking, you know, important business decisions, whether that would be underwriting for insurance or acceptance of credit for purposes of financial transactions, or perhaps even employment-based decisions. The most sophisticated AI tools are capable of running with very limited supervision from people and are capable of making significant business decisions that themselves can carry potential liability, whether it be discrimination or violations of laws related to rules in connection with offering of financial services, and the issue of bias plays a role in all artificial intelligence solutions, and bias in terms of the data that is being operated on, and bias in terms of the impact on certain groups. So, for example, the Apple credit card recently came under fire that there was a disparate impact on women in terms of the offering and extension of credit related to applicants for that Apple credit card. And there was a bank that was behind it, and it was rumored that the bank was taking a black box, unexplainable AI solution to render the decisions about credit limits and scores, and was having a very, very biased output against women. And raised some very interesting questions about bias in terms of data and potentially, you know, using AI solutions that have a disparate impact on protected classes and the legal implications of that, which raises the concept of explainability. Explainability is a concept that's used in the context of AI that refers to the ability for the solution to explain to human beings all of the bases upon which it calculates and recommends decisions. So any of the calculations, any of the decisions that are made have to be explainable to a human in order to meet this explainability test. And I have argued that anytime you're using an AI solution that has the potential to make recommendations or take actions that otherwise would subject an organization to potential liability, that the only way to do that responsibly is by using solutions that are explainable. Because if you wind up in a court case or if you wind up in a regulatory compliance investigation and you're using a so-called black box solution, that would be a solution that may be depending on deep neural networks or other very sophisticated artificial intelligence that isn't by its nature explainable, then you might have a very hard time defending yourself against either a civil case or a regulatory inquiry, because at some point you're going to have to be able to stand behind the decisions that the AI solution either took or recommended. And without explainability, I think you put yourself in a legal liability risk that's potentially untenable. And so I always encourage my clients to avoid getting into using AI solutions that lack explainability if it's going to be in areas where there's a potential for either civil litigation and or regulatory. And as you can imagine, that covers a pretty broad swath of the types of technologies that are out there. So it's not quite a general rule, but it is a very broad recommendation that covers a wide variety of AI-based solutions. And this concept of explainability is one that is going to become extremely important when the law and AI intersect in real cases, whether they be civil cases or regulatory investigations. As we talked about, the data is sometimes the secret sauce. There was a case involving San Francisco Airport and Uber, and Uber had some very significant traffic pattern data and other data that the city of San Francisco was under contract to receive, and the San Francisco Airport wanted it and demanded it from Uber, and there was a court case associated with it. And there are risks that, you know, companies like Uber and others could be forced to divulge the very information that they consider to be proprietary. And in fact, in many instances, there is a strong public interest to have access to such data. In this particular case, the San Francisco Airport lost its claim to require Uber to turn over its records, as the court determined that the contract that Uber had with the city of San Francisco didn't extend to the San Francisco Airport, which was a separate entity. In the end, the real question is going to be, who is liable when something goes wrong? And how do we, you know, dig through the various layers and players associated with a potential AI solution where there is either an injury or some other legally cognizable harm to somebody? And how do we unbundle that, and how do we deal with that? And in a lot of ways, these are unknown risks. And so as lawyers, what we have to do is try to protect our clients that are entering into agreements related to AI, and to do so in a way that recognizes that some of the legal implications of these technologies are as yet to be determined. And so as lawyers, we really have to be thinking about risk balancing in a very broad way, and trying to think about risk in AI to cover as much as we think we can cover, but also to keep it broad enough to where there's some flexibility to for a contract to adapt to emerging case law or additional regulation that's coming down the pipe. And if you think about technology contracts generally, whether you're dealing with IT services or cloud-based services or hosting, you know, over time in the software industry, we've moved away from sort of the focus around the software back in the on-prem days when the vendor was providing us with software to install on our computers and they weren't going to be accessing, you know, issues like indemnity and limitations of liability and insurance coverage were not the deal breaker type terms in on-premises software contract negotiations. As we moved into hosted solutions and then beyond that into cloud, and now as we move into AI-based solutions, we still have to focus on the risk balancing provisions of any deal and to make sure that our clients are getting protected in a way that's commensurate with the upside for the business that is being contemplated. And what we want to do for sure is if we're representing end users that are going to be adopting AI solutions from vendors, that we carefully review the vendor-supplied contracts and really look at these risk balancing provisions and focus in on beefing them up so that the parties have a clearer understanding of who is taking on what risks and what will happen if there's a case and who's going to pay and how much, and all of those issues really go to the advisability of entering into a particular agreement. I can envision a really robust artificial intelligence solution that's being sold on, you know, very one-sided and unfair paper that it may not be advisable for a client to move forward with such a contract, even if the business people or the IT people have determined that this is a very promising technology. And so as lawyers, we need to be focusing on protecting the enterprise and also empowering the enterprise to transform. And those two sort of competing interests are where the rubber meets the road on issues like indemnification, limitations of liability, what types and amounts of insurance coverage and how they can be accessed, and then, of course, regulatory compliance and compliance with applicable laws. These are going to be important provisions to focus our attention on in the context of artificial intelligence because, as I said, there are a number of risks, not all of which are fully developed, many emerging risks on the horizon, and yet a very strong interest in certain organizations to move forward with AI, and in some instances, maybe without a fully thought out strategy. And if you're in that situation as a lawyer, it's a tricky spot to be in, and the tools in your toolbox are going to be in editing, revising, and negotiating all of the contracts associated with a particular project that is involving AI for your organization. So what are the special considerations for risk balancing provisions when you're dealing with AI? I mean, first, we start with the proposition that we want to be as broad as we can because, as we discussed, the law related to AI is unsettled. It's emerging, and we know that there's the potential for personal injuries. We know that there's data-related issues. We know that we could have HR-related claims. We know that we could have other regulatory-type claims that are predicated on disparate impact of protected classes, for example, in the financial services context. If we don't know the race of an applicant, is it possible that an AI could be programmed in such a way that it uses things other than race as a proxy for race, and in so doing delivers credit responses and extension of credit decisions in a way that has a disparate impact on African Americans. And I would suggest to you that the answer is definitely yes. That could be through understanding, for example, demographic data associated with zip codes, for example. Could be even looking at names, individual names. Could be looking at a number of different factors associated with, for example, what type of content do they consume. Think about disparate impact between men and women, right? I think an AI solution could not know the gender of a particular applicant, but might know that one applicant reads GQ magazine and the other applicant reads Southern Living or O or another particular magazine that has a high demographic of women. And so when you start dealing with AI and tools that learn on their own, you run the risk that decisions that are being made from these solutions, while on the one hand are designed to be very formulaic and mathematical in their approach, and therefore you would think would not be biased or discriminate, the truth of the matter is that when it comes to AI, it's a garbage in, garbage out kind of situation, in that the solution is only going to operate on the data sets that it's been provided, and the model is going to be trained to do things in a certain way, largely by individuals that come to the table with certain biases and viewpoints. And the reality is that in all of these contexts, there's a potential for unintended consequences. And when those unintended consequences have a disparate impact on minorities or in other ways show a pattern that one could argue violates law, you're going to be in a potential situation where you're going to have to defend those claims, and you're going to need, you know, good contracts with your vendors to make sure that you're going to be in a strong position to do that. Again, emphasis on explainability here, getting into contracts with AI solution providers that don't wrap and warrant that their solution will be explainable is a potentially serious risk for any business that's operating in a regulatory environment, which these days in the United States, it's virtually every company is subject to one or more regulations, and larger companies, you know, need whole departments to deal with the regulatory burden that faces their business. Moving to indemnification, I think indemnification is a relatively misunderstood concept, but what it does is it describes the types of claims by third parties, typically, that the parties will be obligated to defend and pay for under certain circumstances. So if I am a end user looking to purchase an AI solution, I am going to want, you know, very broad indemnity from the AI solution provider that does a number of things. And at the very least, we would want the solution provider to indemnify the end user for any IP infringement claims. This is fairly standard in the cloud context, even in public cloud. The vendors who are offering solutions predicated on proprietary software almost universally will indemnify their customers for third-party claims alleging that the solution infringes the copyright, trademark, or patent rights of a third party. And so that's a very standard, minimal kind of indemnity that you would expect to see. And if you don't see that, then you certainly would want to add that if you're, you know, dealing with an AI contract. But going beyond that, We recommend that our clients negotiate for very broad indemnity. And here's a laundry list, but you can imagine that, you know, the idea here is let's think up every conceivable third-party claim that might happen, and let's try to get indemnity from the solution provider in case such claims materialize. And you can see this is a broad laundry list, but it includes any failure to comply with applicable law, which obviously is very broad, any breach of confidentiality obligations, which certainly captures, you know, privacy and security related issues, but that doesn't stop there. You see at the bottom, we're recommending very broad indemnity for any violations of privacy or security. Gross negligence, willful misconduct, and fraud is probably the second most common to IP infringement. So you'll see a lot of contracts that will be vendor agrees to indemnify for IP infringement and gross negligence, willful misconduct, or fraud. I would say all of these other ones will be more of a negotiation. The goal here would be we want to create as broad a net possible to capture all of the categories of potential third-party claims. If I'm an end user using an AI solution and I'm about to adopt it in my business, I want to make sure that the vendor is going to stand behind it legally, and one of the important ways for them to do that is to indemnify us if there are going to be third-party claims. And as lawyers, you know, we got to put our creative hats on and try to develop the broadest list possible, again, with the understanding that we don't fully understand all of the third-party types of claims that we may be facing. And so, again, we want to be as broad as possible. Once you cross over the indemnity discussion, which I would submit to you needs to be very heavily negotiated in the context of an AI contract, then, you know, the related issue of limitations of liability needs to be addressed. And limitations of liability will identify the types of damages that would be recoverable if liability was established against one or the other party. Limitation of liability determines the extent of or the types of damages that would be available if liability is proven. And it's very important to understand how these various risk balancing provisions work together. So indemnity defines the circumstances under which one party will defend a claim by a third party against the other. Limitations of liability, therefore, you know, comes in to say, in such a case or in a case between the parties, what types of claims are recoverable and to what extent can they be recovered? And usually there are caps associated with that liability. But one of the things that's critically important is the relationship between the limitation of liability and insurance. So it's common for many organizations to require their vendors to carry appropriate levels of insurance. And in this context, it would include, for example, professional liability coverage, including cyber liability to cover regulatory response or civil claims associated with, for example, data breaches or privacy and security related issues. However, and most of the time, you know, the limitation of liability section will make it to where it's very difficult for the customer of the insured, in this case, the end user, to access the insurance, because let's say the insurance company has issued a $5 million policy. Well, if the limitation of liability says, your cap of liability is three times the fees that you paid for the service, well, those fees likely are nowhere near the $5 million in coverage. And so it's very important to make sure that when you're dealing with insurance and limitations of liability that you consider carving out from the limitations claims that are covered by insurance. And similarly, we often will look at potentially carving out all of the indemnity claims so that you can wind up with a limitation of liability that says, except for the parties' respective obligations in the indemnity section and for claims covered by insurance, the parties agree to the following limitations. And that's what a carve-out is. A carve-out would be a way to describe a group or type of claim and to make it not subject to the limitation of liability. The other thing to think about when you're dealing with AI solutions is it's fairly common in the context of limitations of liability for both parties to disclaim the availability of indirect or inconsequential damage. And those would be sort of any kind of business interruption or lost profits associated with the use of the system. And, you know, there are certain AI solutions for which the most probable claim scenario would result in a loss that would be construed or understood to be an indirect type of damage, such as lost profits or business interruption. And so if you have a situation like that, it's very important to be clear that the sort of standard boilerplate language associated with a disclaimer of any and all indirects for both parties needs to be renegotiated, particularly if you're representing an end user where one of the risks associated with the adoption of the solution is a potential for business interruption or lost profit. And so you just want to be very careful about entering into an AI contract, just broad sweeping limitations of liability that go to those types of issues. In addition, you know, caps that are based on fees, which is probably the most common articulation, for example, you know, the provider's liability under any circumstances shall not exceed 3 times the amount of fees paid by the customer related to the service giving rise to the claim and the prior 12 months before the claim arose. The problem with such articulated caps are that the probable claim scenarios for the end user really have no bearing on the fees that it pays to the vendor. And, you know, caps that are predicated merely on multiples of fees rarely will protect the end user from the types of claims that it would be concerned about. And therefore, insurance becomes an important way to allow the vendor to transfer some of that risk for the customer's benefit. And in many contracts that I write, for example, I will say that the end user can get the greater of some multiple of fees or the available insurance. And in such a articulation, the vendor is protected in the sense that it has to pay out on an uncovered claim, and the customer is protected that claims that would otherwise be subject to insurance coverage, for which there would be, you know, significantly more coverage available than merely the multiple of fees, that the customer gets the benefit of the professional liability without exposing the vendor to anything more substantial than some multiple of fees. And that's been a very successful sort of middle ground that I've been able to strike in negotiating limitations of liability. And again, with the uncertainty around AI, you know, caps on fees, caps predicated on fees should be particularly concerning, especially if the customer doesn't have adequate risk transfer with its own insurance. We're going to definitely want to make sure that those caps are being supplemented with the vendor's professional liability insurance, and that we're writing the limitations of liability and the indemnity and the insurance provisions in a way that don't limit the end user's access to those funds. And so think about caps, very commonly used, but not very friendly to the end user, and potentially very problematic in the event of a claim where your client's harm is substantially greater than the fees paid or the way the cap will be calculated, and then you wind up with an insurance carrier that has, you know, a big policy, but they're telling you you can't access it because you signed this limitation of liability that limits our exposure to some months of fees. And that's the situation that we don't want to find ourselves in. That's the that's where you have a client without a remedy, you know, a serious injury with no remedy, and that would be a big concern. I also think that, you know, customers should not bear the lion's share of the risk related to claims for defects or you know, if the solution doesn't perform consistently with the documentation or the marketing materials, and a claim arises by virtue of the customer's use of the solution in accordance with the documentation, the vendor should stand behind that. It shouldn't be all on the customer to take the lion's share of the risk associated with adoption of the technology. There should be a fair and balanced approach to risk balancing where the vendor is expected to stand behind the product and its people, not to become an insurer itself, but certainly to stand behind those things that are its fault or its responsibility. And they shouldn't, you know, saddle the vendor with being responsible for criminal acts of third parties, for example, or other things beyond its control. But vendors should be held to account for those things that are within its control, or for the negligent acts of its employees, or for claims that arise by virtue of the customer's use of the solution in a way that doesn't constitute a misuse or abuse of the system. Similarly, vendors should not be required to insure all risks that arise from the customer's actions. You know, the customer should be responsible for claims related to its use. It should be responsible for claims related to its data. It should be responsible for claims from its customers, you know, related to its use of the solution. And so there's a balance here. It's, you know, it's a balance of fairness and responsibility, and neither party should be asked to act as insurer for the other. However, both sides should be held legally accountable for the things that are within its control. And that's one of the real challenges with limitations of liability, is that in many instances, the vendors have priced their solution at a zero liability or some, you know, risk associated with a cap. And, you know, they may have a multi-tenant solution where everybody's on the same platform and everybody's got the same terms and conditions. And you come along and say, well, you know, it's our policy not to sign up for these very onerous limitations of liability. And, you know, we need you to reconsider and adjust the cap. And they may have, you know, priced it in a way that doesn't, you know, account for that. And so one of the things that I recommend is that, you know, these types of requirements be communicated early on in the sales process. If there's an RFP process, that lawyers get involved in communicating what the non-commercial requirements are going to be related to the solution. Because if you're a lawyer and you're getting into a negotiation at the very end and you're trying to significantly adjust the risk balancing provisions, you know, the vendor may rightfully say, look, guys, we got this thing approved on the basis of our standard paper. We've got some price concessions in here. You're now essentially renegotiating the essence of the deal, and we're either not going to negotiate or we've got to go to ground zero with respect to the pricing exercise. And as lawyers, that's a tough position to get into, because now you're being looked down either internally by your business leaders, or, you know, if you're outside counsel like me, as being, you know, part of the problem and holding things up. Whereas if these issues were communicated early on in the sales process, you wouldn't have these problems. That being said, you know, I have negotiated many transactions where the limitation of liability was the last deal point. And when I get into deals where it's clear that the parties are pretty far apart on limitations of liability, what I'll recommend is to say, okay, you know, we've heard each other on this, we're still pretty far apart. Let's see how far we can get on the other points. And if we can close those out, maybe we come back to this. And at that point, all of the parties will have a better picture of, you know, what the total deal looks like, both from a monetary and non-monetary perspective, and allow the parties at that point, the decision makers, to come in. Everything else is already finalized. The deal is, you know, queued up. It's ready to go, but for limitation of liability. And that can be an effective way to move the discussions forward, leave this issue for last, and close it out at the very end as the final deal point to be negotiated. Very common strategy in cloud deals that I've worked on. Anytime risk balancing is going to play an important part in the overall solution, as I would suggest in AI it should, saving the limitations of liability for last can be a good legal strategy if you're negotiating contracts on behalf of clients. So insurance has become, you know, really important in the context of IT services generally and cloud services specifically, and I think, you know, even more so when it comes to AI, principally because of the broader array of risks associated with AI. Once you have machines that are potentially being unsupervised and taking business decisions, you're adding a whole different layer of risk complexity than when you're dealing with, for example, cloud solutions that are capable of making calculations but really are not living and breathing in the sense of taking business decisions and learning and so forth. So a slightly different animal when it comes to AI, but the basic principles are the same, which is from an end user perspective, you're going to want to make sure that as much of the business risk associated with the solution is transferred to insurance as is possible. And that would be true whether you're the vendor or the end user. And the principal instrument for risk transfer in an IT solutions situation is going to be that errors and omissions coverage. That's the professional liability insurance that's held by the software developer or the service provider that says basically this is malpractice insurance, the functional equivalent of legal malpractice insurance or medical malpractice. Those are very specific types of errors and omissions. And there's a whole category of insurance that's referred to broadly as tech E&O, technology errors and omissions, and those would be the types of policies that I think would be most important when evaluating an AI transaction. You're going to want to be looking at, if I'm representing an end user, I'm going to want to understand, you know, what are the details of the vendor's tech E&O coverage? You know, what types of things are included? What are the exclusions? You know, what are the coverage amounts? Are there separate schedules for coverages of different items? I'm going to want to really dig into that and understand exactly what types of errors and omissions are covered and what type of indemnity there is. Because again, if you think about an insurance policy, it's really a policy of indemnity between the insurance company and the insured. And if I'm looking at that, I'm going to want to make sure that the insured, in this case, the service provider's indemnity obligations to my client, which would be the end user, mirror very closely the indemnity provisions in the policy, such that there will be no gaps between the indemnity that the end user has with the vendor and what the vendor has with the insurance company, by aligning those indemnity provisions, you're ensuring that the end user customer is going to have access to as much of the insurance policy or coverages as possible. And so I like to, regardless of whether I'm representing the service provider or the end user, I like to do an exercise of aligning the indemnity provisions of the insurance contract for the provider and what goes into the indemnity provisions in the contract. So that's an important interplay between insurance and indemnity. In addition, market forces are such that depending on the size of your organization, the nature of your client, its bargaining power, and so forth, that there will be gaps, that there will be vendors that won't agree to the type of broad indemnity and limited limitations of liability that would put your client in a comfortable position from a risk perspective. And that's where first-party coverage comes in. First-party coverage is coverage that, for example, an end user would have for its own data, and that first-party coverage could apply to, for example, data lost, data stolen, data compromised by a vendor. And so it may be the case that if there were a claim that some of the claim would be paid by the vendor's professional liability and some of the claim could be paid by the customer's first-party cyber liability. So first-party would be the customer's insurance kicking in to the extent that the vendor left them from being completely whole in a claim scenario, that's where the first-party coverage comes in. Third-party cyber is usually an add-on to a tech E&O policy, and that would be the vendor carries the third-party cyber, it runs along with the E&O, and if there is a cyber-related loss, for example, a data breach, then the vendor's insurance company covers claims by the end user's customers for a breach of their data. So it arises under the indemnity, and there's specifically coverage for giving notice, specifically coverage for, in some instances, credit monitoring. There's many instances coverage for class action cases. There's frequently coverage for regulatory response. But that third-party piece, if you're representing an end user, you're going to want to be focusing on the E&O and the cyber and making sure that that all adds up to numbers that will adequately cover your claim scenarios, and then looking deeper at the limitation of liability to make sure that there's nothing in the limitation that restricts your ability through caps or otherwise to access that coverage. So again, you know, the type of formulation that you might think about with a carve-out is except for claims arising under the party's indemnity obligations in section XYZ and for claims that are covered by insurance, comma, the provider's liability under any circumstances will be limited to, for example, you could say the greater of some multiple or insurance, or you could just leave the insurance completely carved out. And if it's a claim that's not covered, go with a multiple of revenue. And again, that protects both sides in the sense that the uncovered claims have a very limited risk exposure that's logically and mathematically related to the fees. And yet the customer is able to access the E&O and third-party cyber, which the only reason that the vendor has it is for the customer. I mean, it's insurance to protect the customer. So why would we want to pay these premiums and then not allow a customer to access the coverage by virtue of a limitation of liability that would essentially potentially eviscerate the benefit of such coverage? So that's insurance, a pretty complicated area, very much intertwined with the indemnity and limitations of liability. And that's why I refer to these all as risk balancing provisions, because you really need to look at them together, because they work in tandem with each other. And You can't really understand them in a vacuum. They really need to be used together to create a particular risk balancing outcome that's appropriate for the deal. Regulatory compliance is a big issue with AI. I think it's emerging. I've written already this year several articles about new legislation. I've talked about Article 22 of GDPR that makes it illegal to use AI for profiling purposes. California has a new Privacy Act that in a lot of ways emulates GDPR. And in California, for example, there's been laws that have passed that make use of deep fakes, which is a type of AI, in the context of celebrities, you know, spoofing celebrities, using AI, and also making it illegal to use deep fakes in the context of political ads or campaigns. And so we're starting to see very specific legislation. In Illinois, they passed a law that says you cannot use automated interviewing processes through AI. For example, one solution allows candidates to submit videos, and the AI actually analyzes the content of the videos and scores them. And in Illinois now, there's a law that says you can't do that as an employer without first disclosing it to the applicant and getting their consent. And so we're starting to see in many ways the same sort of notice and choice strategy that the United States has used towards privacy regulation historically. We're starting to see very specific examples of that type of legislation popping up, specifically targeted at AI. And my take on it is similar to what we've seen in tech, you know, more generally and specifically with cloud and other areas, privacy and security, you know, that we're just scratching the surface on what I think will be a regulatory explosion of both state and potentially federal legislation that is specifically targeted at artificial intelligence solutions. Thank you very much and have a wonderful day.